when I say Rocky starred, I mean it in the sense of Rocky the movie, because I came out here to punch you in the face. And also, I don't talk so good.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun.
So, welcome to Over There, the podcast about military history and activism in the age of Trump. My name is Terry Brennan. I'm an actor and director who lives in Philadelphia.
And I'm Matt Martin. I'm a retired Air Force officer.
This week, we have a lot to talk about because in the age of Trump, a lot happens and a lot happens quickly. I listen to a lot of news podcasts, and the new thing that almost all of them do is they talk about, we recorded this at X time on this day and something may have happened since then.
Yeah, things happen.
Between us recording and you listening. So there's a lot we want to sort of jump into this week and talk a little bit about, again, military history and the activism.
So much stuff.
So many things to talk about. Let's get a little bit caught up. First of all, Matt, so how have you been? What have you been up to recently since we recorded last?
Well, you know, last time we were talking, I mentioned that the thing I was going to be paying attention to was the deliberations that were going on inside the Pentagon and inside Washington about the approach to the global war on terror, as it used to be called. And now it's just counterterrorism operations, because Donald Trump had made a few comments about establishing safe zones, that one of the things he was going to do to control the flow of refugees was to have there be fewer refugees by establishing so-called safe zones inside Syria, where if you're getting hunted down by ISIS, you could go there and you'd be safe. But of course, you have to, you know, there aren't just safe zones. Somebody has to make them safe. And that somebody tends to be the U.S. military. And so I was very keen to see what was going to happen, whether they were going to come out with actual plans to send 30,000 troops to Syria to set up these safe zones, you know, because you'd have to fight your way in. You'd have to clear an area. You'd have to secure that area and hold it. And then you'd have to establish a process whereby a very quickly building line of many people would be queuing up to get in there because they're trying desperately to get away from ISIS. So that would require a huge footprint of U.S. military or some coalition force. So I was waiting to see what kind of plans were going to come out.
So, Matt, did any good plans come out of this?
No good plans came out of this. It turns out it didn't go much past the tweet stage, which may be,
that might be maybe how we need to get used to.
That's probably how the Trump administration is going to work. There'll be most of the good ideas will be vetted via tweet, and then only the ones that they really, really care about will get beyond that into the executive order stage, which apparently is the next stage of the way Trump administers foreign policy. No, what happened instead was business as usual. And of course, the most obvious example of business as usual was the raid in Yemen, whereby we sent in special forces, in this case, Navy SEALs, the vaunted SEAL Team 6, to raid a compound in Yemen, ostensibly to collect intelligence, but probably to bag up, as they say, some specific Al-Qaeda or terrorist leader that they want to get their hands on. You know, the only reason they do raids in parts of the world like Yemen instead of just blowing the place up from the air is because they actually want to get somebody and collect that intelligence.
So talk to me really quickly, because I heard a lot about this raid. I heard that we lost a soldier, right? Someone died.
Yeah, one of the SEALs died because one of the helicopters crashed. You know, when they do these kind of operations, they usually send in two or three helicopters. They tend to be H-60 Blackhawks, but the special forces have some highly modified versions that we found out about from the Bin Laden raid that are H-60 helicopters, but have been modified to be quieter, maybe to have a lower radar signature. So they're ingressing, as we say, or being inserted into an area in these helicopters, and then they typically hit the ground, sort of secure the perimeter of the area that they are assaulting, and then kick down the door and head in and start going room by room to either get their guy or to collect the intelligence material that they're after. So the Navy SEAL that was killed, we think, and I should point out that, you know, I'm retired now. I'm not privy to any classified information. I'm only speculating based on what I can dig up in open sources. But it appears that there was some kind of mechanical malfunction on one of those helicopters. It had to perform a hard landing, and one of the troops was killed in that hard landing.
There was also, because here's the thing, I have been really focused on a lot of things this week. I've been focused in the week before, and I've been focused on a lot of Trump issues, and I've been focused on a lot of congressional issues. So to be honest, this is something that I heard. I probably heard like three or four different reports on this, but I didn't go digging too deeply. So I actually don't know too much about what this situation is, other than like the headlines. I know the headlines, and that's kind of all.
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit what kind of precedent does this set? Like, this is like the first military raid that we've done since Trump.
Yeah.
And it seems to be that it's really, really public. And I don't know if that's on purpose or not, meaning like, I don't know if like there was leaks or how we got to know this, but it seems to be a really public, really big deal. And it seems to be like a kind of a big, embarrassing moment for the Trump administration, but also kind of for us as a country. So talk to me a little bit about what this sort of potentially does, I guess, for the next, you know, how does this set the stage for what we expect to see militarily from this administration, or do we know?
Sure. Well, we can make some pretty educated guesses. We should start with a little bit of background. You know, there's a reason why now, when we are pursuing counterterrorism objectives, we're trying to actually stop Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, that we rely on these types of special operations. It actually goes back to the opening days of Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, you know, shortly after 9/11, when we went in to Afghanistan to topple the Taliban and then to go after bin Laden and the rest of Al-Qaeda there. You know, in the past, like historically, if you need to neutralize a security threat that is emanating inside a country and there's no government there that can do that for you, you know, there's no police force that's going to go get bin Laden. You have to do that with large numbers of troops, you know, to the tune of hundreds of thousands of troops in a place like Afghanistan, because you have to control the population and then you have to remove the power base of these insurgent groups. And their power base is inevitably the civilian population, just like that's the power base of ISIS right now in places like Mosul and Raqqa and North Syria. But Donald Rumsfeld, who was the Secretary of Defense when 9/11 happened, had this idea, and that is, we have grown so sophisticated in our technological capabilities that we don't need to do that anymore. We don't need to send in 500,000 troops into Afghanistan to eliminate that security threat. We can send in 10 dudes with a radio and then support them with air power, and they can hunt down, you know, they can team up with local sources, they can hunt down their specific objectives, and then we can bomb them. Right. And that's why in the opening days of OEF, that's what you saw. You saw special operations troops, some of them on horseback, some of them in, you know, unarmored Humvees, hunting down Al-Qaeda. And there's a lot of debate about the effectiveness of this sort of approach. But there's a lot of good thinking to suggest that the reason why bin Laden escaped from Afghanistan in October of 2001 is because we took this approach, right? We tried to rely on local sources and then use just a handful of special operations folks backed up by air power to go after him. And that was not effective enough. And he was able to slip away into Pakistan where we couldn't get him. But that didn't dissuade Donald Rumsfeld. And when we invaded Iraq, right, he was not going to be deterred from this approach.
Rumsfeld never hit me as a dissuadable fellow.
Not super dissuadable, not super introspective. He doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about whether or not the thing he thought was a good thing or a bad thing. He just sort of gets an idea and runs with it. So when we invaded Iraq in March of 2003, we still had this idea. There was lots of generals telling the secretary that, hey, you're going to have to send in 500,000 troops to do the thing that you want to do, which is install democracy in Iraq. And Rumsfeld wasn't having it. And he managed to bludgeon the Pentagon until they pared down the invasion force to about 150,000 troops. And then we just barreled our way into Iraq, and we had, I was there, I was flying missions. At the time I was flying missions out of Crete, which is an island, in the Mediterranean. It's a Greek island. And so we were flying missions out of Crete, through Turkish airspace into northern Iraq to do reconnaissance missions. So we had no problem picking apart the Iraqi military, such as it was, because it just wasn't that capable. But then, as we all know, we spent the next 10 years battling this insurgency, because we just didn't have the forces on hand to control Iraq. And by the way, we decided it was a great idea to completely dismantle the Iraqi government, the Iraqi military, all the things that you normally rely on to control a population and to help you achieve your security objectives. We just got rid of all that, and half of those guys turned into insurgents. So the U.S. military in that process learned this lesson. And the lesson is, don't send in a lot of troops. Let's try to manhunt our way to victory. And we spent a tremendous amount of time trying to do that in Iraq. And in fact, I spent a couple hundred hours flying Predator missions, where I was part of the team that was hunting down a guy by the name of al-Zarqawi, who was a leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And we spent tremendous resources on getting this guy. We ultimately got him.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, we
got him. I remember that. I had no idea. That's really exciting. So you were part of that.
I was part of that. I flew dozens of missions, hundreds of hours, looking for Zarqawi, staring at houses where we thought he might be or might show up for hours at a time, tracking his associates, staring at their houses. And then whenever we sort of fixed one of Zarqawi's guys, they would send in, very similar to this Yemeni raid, they would send in a special operations team and a couple of Black Hawk helicopters into the area, kick down the door, bundle the guy up, and then take him back to, you know, at the time it was, we had a few places, but Abu Ghraib was the most notorious of them, but there were others. And then they would, whatever intelligence they collected from this guy, either through interrogation or through, you know, looking at numbers in his cell phone, they would figure out who else they need to go after. And they'd spend all day, all night long, every day, nabbing specific al-Qaeda guys or specific Mahdi militia or other Sunni, you know, insurgent groups or whatever, right? And we just devoted a tremendous amount of time and energy and resources, and a lot of people got killed. And at the end of the day, it didn't make much of a what we would call an operational impact, right? It didn't change the nature of al-Qaeda. It didn't change the nature of the conflict in Iraq. And it really took this other thing called the Sunni Awakening, whereby, you know, because al-Qaeda was so terrible in those Sunni-dominated areas, especially in western Iraq, that the Sunnis who are not part of al-Qaeda said, these guys are worse than the Americans, so we're going to help the Americans drive out al-Qaeda. But that occurred in the midst of this just utterly catastrophic Iraqi civil war. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were killed. You know, that was all going on during the so-called surge under General Petraeus. That sort of led to the winding down of the U.S. mission in Iraq. But the lesson that we took from that is sending in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of troops is just going to be a colossal mess. And let's not do that, even if it means we never defeat al-Qaeda. But if we can most of the time blow up their leaders, hence all the drone operations that are reported in places like Pakistan and Yemen and East Africa, but from time to time send in special operations troops to capture that guy, we may not be able to defeat al-Qaeda or wipe them from the face of the earth, but we can at least keep them operationally degraded to the point where they can't launch another 9/11, and we just do that forever. So by authorizing this raid in Yemen very quickly, soon into his presidency, Donald Trump is sort of signaling that we're going to keep doing that. We're not going to dramatically change our anti-terrorism approach in the world. We are going to hunt down specific al-Qaeda, ISIS, Boko Haram, al-Shabaab leaders one at a time in hopes that we won't defeat them totally, but we'll keep them knocked off their heels and they'll never be able to come after us with much gusto.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the success or lack thereof of this this raid. So it looks like we're not changing strategy very much. And it looks like what you're saying is that Obama was sort of operating under this same template. Yes,
sure. He bought into it wholeheartedly because the last thing he wanted to, you know, when he ran in 2008, it was under the promise that he's going to get us out of Iraq, which he did, and that we're just not going to do those kind of operations anymore, where we're trying to forcibly bring a country into democracy. So this was very attractive to him, right? It was, you know, right now we only have 8,000 troops. At the peak our effort in Afghanistan, we had 150,000 troops there. Right now we have 8,000. We've probably got about 4,000 troops in Iraq. At the peak of our effort there, we had almost 250,000 Americans there. So this is obviously, it's terrible, and you don't want any of your guys getting killed, but this is a, you know, much less costly approach to counterterrorism than the approach of George W. Bush. And Obama was right there behind all of it.
Now, I remember there was a lot of talk with people I knew, and I know someone who works for the State Department. I don't know him well. He's a friend of a friend of a friend, but I see him like twice a year at big friend gatherings, and he talked a lot about Obama sort of signing on to a lot of the same things that George W. Bush was doing in the Middle East, specifically in and around Iraq. And actually, I've gotten into a lot of arguments with liberal friends who I think really wanted to distance Obama from George W. Bush. And they were like, no, he's coalition building and he's doing this and that. And I wasn't really intelligent enough to dig my heels in, I guess you would say, and be like, no, yeah, listen here, because Jim from the State Department says. But it was one of those things where I was like, I was told that he's kind of following the same playbook. And I said, and also the people that I talked to didn't seem super upset about it, but they did find a certain amount of frustration in the way certain Democrats and certain liberals would talk about Obama differently than George W. Bush. And they were like, well, mostly, I mean, there's a lot of things he's doing differently, but as far as counterterrorism is concerned, he's kind of using the same playbook. So you would say that that's kind of roughly about right. Is that true?
Well, what Obama did that was different than George W. Bush, because, you know, George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz, and this is well documented by Cy Hirsch in his series of books about the Bush presidency, their idea was, we're America, damn it. If we go somewhere, and people everywhere love freedom, because freedom.
Yeah, that's a big one. That is actually, that was a big thing. And I'll get to that because I feel like this administration is playing with that idea too. But keep going. Because freedom.
We're the United States. If we just put our hands into the Middle East, dictatorships will topple and the freedom-loving people of the earth will rush to join our cause. And they will quickly, with no help from us, build a shining democracy in Iraq, and then we can go home conquering heroes. You know, nothing like that happened. We were able to quickly vanquish the Iraqi military, but we were almost instantly beset by an insurgency. And because, you know, we didn't want to leave Iraq as a smoldering ruin, we just kept increasing our commitment there until we had 250,000 Americans. And we're spending $1 billion every 3 days to try to patch together some kind of stable Iraq. The thing is, we kind of did, right? That effort kind of worked. It didn't, in 2011, it didn't bear any resemblance to the original vision that Cheney and George W. Bush had, but it was stable and they had a government and the government had sort of a democratic process. But it was still sharply split along sectarian lines. And when this thing called ISIS poured in through Syria, the Shiites whose job it was to defend Sunnis in places like Mosul just were not going to have any part of that and immediately got out of there and let ISIS move in. So the part that Obama zeroed in on was the manhunting counterterrorism approach that took place in the midst of the overall U.S. Nation-building project under George W. Bush.
I see. So let me ask you a quick question. So I want to sort of wind this down, or at least take this in a different direction,
yeah,
which is, so with all of this, we have the raid that just happened, seems to be in the template of what we were talking about before, like special operations. You send in 10 guys with a radio instead of 10,000 guys.
Yeah.
So this raid seems to have not gone well. Right. We don't know the objective because obviously that would probably be classified. I'm sure they're not going to come out and just tell everyone like, this is why we were there, and then let us judge for ourselves.
Yeah.
And also, you know, intelligence reasons. But when something like this goes this wrong, what does that tell us about what might be to come? Is this a speed bump? Is this,
sure.
there was a lot of reports saying that it was a really impulsive decision. Obviously you and I will never know that for sure.
Right.
But there were leaks saying it was an impulsive decision. And there were leaks saying that it was the intelligence. One report I read said like the intelligence was 10 years old, but they were saying that bad intelligence and impulsive decision-making, is this something that we might have to like get used to seeing? Is this something that is just, oh, they're figuring it out? Like, what are we,
sure,
what do we think is coming down the pike here?
Well, there's a few conclusions that we can draw based on U.S. counterterrorism operations in the past. One is that for them to launch this raid. So there's this idea, I think, in popular American culture that our special operations guys are so good, so just amazing, superhuman, that they can ride a helicopter into a compound, kick down a door, get a guy, get their intelligence, get back out, and nobody will even know that they were there, right? Or they certainly not going to shoot up the place and cause a lot of civilian casualties.
That's how it went in Navy SEALs. I saw that movie.
That's right. They're superheroes, right? Mm-hmm. But in the real world, that's never how it goes. You know, even in the cleanest, most well-executed, well-planned operation, it's going to be a huge mess and people are going to get killed. And whenever you send in men with guns into an area where people live, it's going to be a mess, right? And that's why we stopped doing it for the most part. That's why we started using unmanned aircraft in Pakistan, because sending in special operations is messier, right? As messy as it is to blow up a house from 20,000 feet, it's even messier to send in 30 guys with guns to try to find their guys, because they have to protect themselves, right? Which means they have to neutralize anything that's even remotely a threat to them. And when you inject troops into a dense urban area, there's a lot of things that could potentially be threats to them. And they're going to take action to protect themselves, as I think we would all expect them to. So if they were going to do this, you know, Donald Trump aside, the men and women who lead those special operations and plan them are super professional, and they have a ton of experience, and they know what they're doing, and they know that these type of operations are very, very risky, right? We went after bin Laden because the potential payoff, capturing bin Laden, was going to be a huge strategic victory, and so we were willing to take the risk of having some of our guys get killed and killing civilians. If they decided to launch this raid, there must have been something there that was very, very important to them. Probably an Al-Qaeda leader, a very high up Al-Qaeda leader. Maybe some intelligence that they expected to be there. Maybe there were some computers that they expected to find, not just a treasure trove of intel. But it was probably a specific individual. Otherwise, they just would have blown it up, right? If it was a lower level Al-Qaeda guy, they just would have blown the place up from the air. But what happened in the past was Obama took this stuff very seriously, and whenever he had to approve one of these missions that the special operations guys thought was important enough to launch, they would convene in the Situation Room of the White House, and he would get fully briefed on the entire operation and exactly what they were planning to do and the risks they were involved and the civilian casualties that they expected to incur, and then he would decide if it was worth it or not. And that apparently didn't happen. Apparently, from the reports, Donald Trump took a much more casual attitude and just sort of trusted the guys. This particular operation wasn't much messier than your typical special operations injection into this type of target. Maybe a little bit, you know, if they had a mechanical issue on board that helicopter, such that they had to do a hard landing and get one of our troops killed, that's probably why there were so many civilian casualties, right? They had to secure that area, and anything that looked like a threat, they weren't going to even mess with. And it was, of course, the middle of the night, so they can get their guys out. So the concerning thing here is not necessarily the operation, but the level of review that Donald Trump put into prior to approving it. My guess is that the guys inside the Pentagon are going to learn from this, and realize that Trump does not have their back, right? That he's not going to ask a lot of tough questions and give a lot of serious strategic thought to the operations that they are requesting. So they might be a little bit more careful in the future before they bring to him some plans when it comes to deciding on airstrike versus soft raid. But otherwise, we're going to see more of these.
I want to jump into a related issue here. And the related issue is something that you and I were talking a little bit about earlier before we started recording, which is sort of like how to engage with someone about this, about these kind of topics. And those who engage with sort of like goodwill or those who engage with lack of goodwill. And what I mean by that is like when you and I sit down, you and I might have different points of view on something. Often we have similar points of view, but even if we have different points of view, both you and I are willing to give the other one at least the benefit of the doubt. You're a person who has thoughts. And yeah. That's worthy of me. That's worthy of me listening to said thought. So I'm going to treat you like a human being. And I'm also going to speak with you relatively candidly. I mean, we're all nervous about losing face when we have conversations that are heated. No one wants to look like they don't know what they're talking about. But at the same time, there is a certain courtesy that you sort of both people have to get on board with. And that courtesy is sort of accepting a little bit of what the other person has to say, or at least letting it be said and addressing it on the terms that they said it, or at least in a respectful manner.
Boy, it's so hard to have a conversation, you know, and not just get into an argument.
Exactly. It's really hard to do that. And the issue about this Yemen raid, which I want to use to transition into talking to your friends and relatives and things like that. But before we get there, the White House press secretary, my new favorite SNL character, Sean Spicer.
Wasn't that brilliant?
That was one of my favorite sketches. I watched that. It's rare that I watch Saturday Night Live. I happened to watch that in real time. And we all had a talk about what sketches we thought were going to like go viral. And there's another sketch that happened that night that was about a Totino's commercial where someone's wife sort of has this lesbian love affair while the guys are watching the Super Bowl, and everyone was like, I think that's going to go viral. I was like, I think that Melissa McCarthy one is going to hit. I go, that reminds me of like old school Chris Farley. Like her energy was just
right. And it was just too good. Right. It was just too capturing, you know, it now seems like when Sean Spicer gets up there, it seems more like he's now doing an impersonation of Melissa McCarthy than the other way around. You know?
That's exactly right. And actually that which is just a testament to her brilliance as a performer.
Yeah.
So the issue here that I wanted to get onto is that my new favorite SNL character, Sean Spicer, comes out and when talking about this raid, took a really condescending point of view to all questions asked about it. Now, I get it. Like, I get it in the sense that like a lot of these reporters, we're going to say first, we're going to give Sean Spicer the benefit of the doubt. And I don't like Sean Spicer, so I think that says a lot.
Yeah.
But we're going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that these reporters are asking tough questions, maybe even gotcha questions, and maybe and definitely whether you're on Sean Spicer's side or not, they're asking pointed questions because that's the job of a journalist.
Yeah.
But the way that he dealt with the room, I thought was incredibly disrespectful. And it was very condescending in the sense that he came out to say that this was a win for sure. They were gathering intelligence. They got the intelligence they wanted. And anyone who suggests otherwise is basically urinating on the grave of the soldier who died.
Right. Which is that it's like, how dare you even ask these questions? How dare you question anything that we would do? But the implication is that whatever they got out of that, whatever intel they got out of that, was worth the price of this U.S. special operations troop, right? That was worth this human life. And if you don't think it was, how dare you?
Exactly. And the issue that this kind of brings up is that I know I've heard a lot of senators. I think John McCain was one of them. Maybe I forget who else, but John McCain was definitely one of them. They spoke with John McCain about some of Trump's comments unrelated to the Yemen raid. They were just like, what do you think about this comment and that comment? And John McCain went on this thing about how, well, I'm not going to spend my time on comments because I'm a senator and I have things that I want to get done. And I agree with Donald Trump on some things and I disagree with him on a lot of things. So I'm going to fight him on the issues that I disagree with. And I'm going to try to get things done with him on issues that we agree upon. And so he went on to say, like, so all this talk about how he's talking on Twitter and how he's talking in press conferences and how Sean Spicer's addressing things isn't really important. And I'm going to go and say that from John McCain's point of view, again, I'm going to give John the benefit of the doubt and say that, sure, if he's interested in like pragmatic sort of dealings, then sure, he can go on and say, like, I'm not going to busy myself with speculation on what Donald Trump meant. I do understand that that's an attractive thing to do, especially if the party that everyone's angry at is in your political party. So I can understand him wanting to sidestep that. Yeah. But I'm going to go on to say that this, the way that Sean Spicer dealt with this Yemen raid, the way that the White House in general sort of talked to us, the public, about how this went, sort of signals, or I shouldn't say signals, what I should say is sort of sets a mood of how conversations may take place. Like, basically what they're saying is like, hey, we're putting out our point, we're putting out our point aggressively. And so anybody who kind of falls on that side of it, then if you're like a casual, what I would call a casual Republican, if you're someone who's like, well, I watch the news sometimes and sometimes I agree with them and sometimes I don't, you're, yeah, you're kind of creating a sort of soil for these arguments to happen in that is really awful and nasty. I think that it's tough to say that, like, it's tough to look at Sean Spicer's demeanor and say, yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I think that that's a totally good way to talk to the press. And one can be frustrated and combative, but what this is, what I'm all bringing this down to is, as someone who does a lot of activist work, I even had a meeting today with a friend of mine about some of the different things we want to do, how we want to accomplish certain things. And one of the things that my friend Karen said to me is, Karen was like, well, you know, we have to reach out. We really have to make a point to extend our hands and try to reach across that aisle. And I said, I really want to do that. However, how do you deal with people? And when I say people, I mean, there are, you know, there, like, there's good Democrats and there's bad Democrats. There's good Republicans and there's bad Republicans. How do you deal with a debate adversary who doesn't want to bring goodwill into it, doesn't want to give that courtesy we talked about? We're like, I'm going to let you give your point of view and I'm going to give an argument. Like, you're going to argue for a point and I'm going to say, I hear you. I'm going to argue for the other point. That is very different than saying, if you even bring this up, you're unpatriotic. So my question is, when we're doing activism, when we're making phone calls, when we're trying to engage, just a lot of times for a lot of people, I feel like it's like work acquaintances who might bring something up. Something might come up where they're like, well, you know, that Yemen raid was a huge success. And I mean, like, it is true. It is disrespectful to talk badly about it. How does one engage that person? Does someone even engage that person? Like, what's too far gone? Basically, if we're trying to establish a really good public discourse, my question that I'm kind of struggling with right now is when to engage and how to engage, because also I don't want to give any ground. I don't want to, like, for onlookers, for someone who's watching what I'm talking about, I don't want to accidentally give ground to my opponent. Like, if there's a third party watching, I don't want them to walk away and go, yeah, I guess Terry doesn't know what he's talking about because I was too nice. But at the same time, I don't want it to be a shouting match. So I'm going to kick this to you. And then I've got a couple of ideas about maybe how to engage people as well and who they are. But what's your thought on that?
My thought is, so, you know, this is coming from my experience of spending 22 years as a Bull Moose progressive in the military, where if I'm going to talk to somebody about something that I know right away they don't agree with me around, how do I do that? Well, I have some common ground. Me being in the military and you also being in the military, we know that we have already decided that we are here for the same reason, and we kind of have the same goal in mind, right? We want to defend the United States. We want to uphold the Constitution. And as much acrimony as there has been, especially since the election of Trump, you would still have a very difficult time finding anybody on either side of any argument who would say, screw the Constitution. Right? I mean, even the hardest core Trump supporter is going to say, well, of course I'm talking about the Constitution. In fact, this is what I care about, and I think we are supporting the Constitution. You can find some common ground. I know it sounds a little cliche, find common ground, but we are all Americans. There's a few things we all agree on, right? You're not going to find anybody who doesn't think that the Constitution is a good idea. You're not going to find anybody who says, like, you know, there was a lot of this during the Iraq War. A lot of people would go around and say, I'm against the war, but I'm for the troops. And I have no doubt that they are utterly sincere, right? Nobody wants our finest young men and women to get shipped off to be killed. You may completely disagree with the administration about the policy, but you may think, well, I really would like to get those troops home safe and sound so they can go back to their lives. You know, if you're talking to somebody who disagrees about this Yemeni raid, nobody's going to say, you know, I'm pretty glad that that guy, Petty Officer Ryan Owens, is dead now, because who needs that guy? They're all going to say that is an utter tragedy. And from there, you can say, well, maybe we should talk about the real cost of these types of operations. And do you really think that we put all the thought into this that we should have? And maybe from there, you can have a discussion.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm glad you brought up the Constitution, because Karen and I were discussing exactly that, the Constitution. She actually printed out the Constitution, and we were sitting there over lunch discussing...
It's a good exercise.
Yeah, right? We were discussing how to get more people to read the Constitution, because the Constitution, if for those of you who are listening, isn't actually as long as you think. I listened to a different podcast called Overdue, and which sounds a lot like Over There, but it's not
different podcast,
different guys. And Overdue is actually about the books you've been meaning to read. I really like it. I've been listening to it a long time, but after the election, they decided to read the Constitution. They said, we've been reading a lot of like literature. We've been reading all these books. And they said, and you know, one of the things that never occurred to me until recently is one of the things that I've been meaning to read is the Constitution. So they read it. No, they didn't read it on the podcast. They just break it down piece by piece. But they said they found a lot of interesting things in there. And that what they were really surprised about is it's not that long. Karen and I were talking about something similar, where we were discussing how do we get more people to sort of like take a look at the Constitution?
Yeah.
Because the word unconstitutional is a pretty used phrase.
It's a go-to phrase.
Yeah, it is go-to. It was used during the Bush years. It was used during the Obama years. It was used during, or it's used now. I have a friend who we're not on great terms right now because we argue a lot about politics. He's very libertarian. He would often throw the Federalist Papers at me. And I haven't read those. I've read some of them.
Yeah.
The issue with the Federalist Papers is I'd have to say, like, that's not technically the Constitution. Like, that's...
Yeah.
It's a thing, but it's not a legal document. It's pamphlets that people wrote to sort of be like, this is why you should pay attention to the Constitution.
It was an argument, a series of arguments.
Exactly, a series of arguments. So we were saying, I'm glad you brought up the Constitution, because it is one of those things where Karen and I decided that we should read the Constitution, and we should read it, she and I, not the general populace. Although if anyone out there wants to read the Constitution, I actually really highly recommend it.
Yeah.
The idea to look it over, and some of it's really dense. Some of it is like, you're like, ooh, but luckily it's not super long. But it is one of those things where you take a look.
There's stuff in there that you just would not believe, right? Like,
that's true.
Like, you know, slavery is enshrined in the Constitution. It was a thing that we decided was going to be part of the founding of our nation. And it's in there. It's in black and white. You can't deny it.
You know, what's really interesting is they talked about that on this other podcast. They talked about that on Overdue. They talked about how amazing how it's in there, but it's not in there. They were like, boy, it is floating all over this whole document. And they talk about it in really coded ways. And it's because of the fact that some of the founding fathers were very pro-slavery and some of them were very anti-slavery.
Sure.
And they just were like, well, this is never going to take off if we don't at least...
They needed the Southerners, and the Southerners were not going to give up slavery.
Exactly. And so one of the things that I think is really important is familiarizing yourself, or in my case, familiarizing myself with this document. And the reason for that is what you just said. Like, I think that I'm trying to find a way to have common ground, but also I think a big part of my growing up was I grew up in Catholic school, and I grew up with some parents who were very this or that. It's either this or it's that. And so sometimes I feel like, oh, well, if I'm going to be civil with this person, I personally feel like I have to like give ground. And the thing that I've learned as being an activist is finding where you can hold your ground, but still be reasonable, rational. Not, I don't think rational is a word, but
I like it.
Reasonable, rational.
Let's
and
use it.
Respectful. Yeah, let's use it. That's the name of the episode. Reasonable and rational.
And all so, right.
But I think that it's important because you're right. I think the one thing we have is an actual written down document. And of course we can argue it. I mean, look at the Supreme Court. You have people who, like this new guy who's being lauded as Trump's choice for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, he's what they call a literalist. He actually believes that the intent of the person writing a document doesn't matter. What matters is how they worded it, and that determines the law.
Yeah.
Now, I might take a different approach to that, but my point is, at least me and Neil Gorsuch could sit down, and I know that he's dying to sit down with me. I know that Neil and I could sit down, and we could at least start from the Constitution. I feel like I'd leave that conversation frustrated because he's probably better at it.
Yo, Neil, let's talk about this equal protection clause.
Exactly, right? Well, you know what? Maybe we could get Neil on the podcast. I'm sure that he's probably doing
he's making the rounds.
The senator's rounds. Yeah. So yeah, I'll just put this out there. Neil, you're welcome on the podcast anytime you want to come
anytime.
On.
Open invitation.
Anytime. It has to be on a Friday though, around 3 roughly.
That's right.
Cuz that's when we record. But
that's when we record the podcast.
Yeah. So the secret's out. So, but anyway, I think I think the thing that I'm coming to is finding a place of using common ground. And if it's not the Constitution, like let's say, because Liv, you're getting into a conversation with someone at work and you've decided it's important enough to engage. Someone is saying something that is, it's awful. Like it's nasty. It's rough. And you're like, I need to stand up here. You know, you got to start somewhere in common. I'm sure that your coworker isn't going to have their pocket constitution. You're gonna be like, hey, pull that out really quick. What we need to talk about is, just look at Article 1 really quick.
Yeah.
But it is important to at least establish, you know, common ground. I think what you were saying is like, so, well, I think we can both agree that we want what's best for the United States. I mean, right there is somewhere to start. That's a little bit broad, but you got to start somewhere.
Sure.
The trick is what I'm finding is also there's the when to walk away. I'm sure we all know that one. We've all walked away to plenty of these.
Yeah.
And then the bigger one is when you have to put on the brakes with what someone's talking about. And what I mean by that is when you have to say, hey, that's not acceptable.
Yeah.
It's not acceptable for you to talk about that. And in those cases, what I usually try to do myself, and I'm curious to hear what you do in this, is a lot of times it involves someone saying something that is really insensitive, either racially, or I run into a lot of it with LGBT stuff because I work in environments like the theater where you'll have people who are, you have a lot of like gay or lesbian people who are part of the community, but you might also have someone who just wanders in to the community and has something like really not sensitive to say, really awful to say. Yeah. And you can't just, or just having a lot of those people in my life, they might just wander into my life. I might be doing a day job. Like I might be waiting tables and someone has something really ignorant to say. And it's important at that moment that I say something like, you know what? I can't really, and this is usually how I address it. I can't really control like, you know, what you think or how you say things, but I'm going to say that you can't say that around me. Like it's not acceptable. I'm going to ask you not to say that around me. And if you say it again, you know, I might have to talk to somebody because as we all know, you can't talk about that way in the workplace. You can't use racial slurs or talk poorly about minority groups. And so it's a tricky thing is when to reach out and
it
when
it should go without
it
saying.
It should go, but it doesn't oftentimes.
It should just be a given. Hey, don't use a racial slur around your friend who identifies with that group, right? That's just, it's amazing that we even have to say something like that, right?
Well, you know what I get? I get it a lot because they're not around. I get a lot. Yeah. I get it because people look at me and they're like, you're a white guy. You clearly lift weights. You're probably racist just like me. Like, that's kind of the implication. Or they're like, hey, you seem really straight. Let's talk about gay guys and how stupid they are. So it's important in those moments that I don't, at the very minimum, I sort of draw a line about the space where I'm like, yo, man, I can't tell you how to think. I usually try to lead with that. I'm like, but you can't say that. You can't say that around me. It's not acceptable. And then I kind of just try to cut it and walk away because if they're not coming at you from a place of good intentions, if they're like, hey, I've got something hateful to say, or hey, I've got something awful to say, you have to figure out when you're going to put the brakes on and when you're going to engage and say, hey, let's talk about that. Because that's kind of, that's not very sensitive because some people are amenable to it, but I find that sometimes people are not.
Right. Yeah. You know, I get this all the time, especially, you know, I participate in a lot of activities where there are old people around, you know.
I've got the bro-y straight guys, and you've got the old people.
Yeah, you know. So it's Civil Air Patrol, a lot of retired gentlemen I'm a member of an organization called the Dalians, which is a fraternal order of military aviators. A lot of white retired guys, you know, who used to fly airplanes. Because we were coming sort of from this common background, they often just assume that I'm coming from the same perspective, whether that be supporting Donald Trump or being a Republican or just thinking that Muslims are bad, right?
Yes.
When you're talking to somebody and you like a person, right? You're talking to them about something that you care about, like, you know, for me, it's flying airplanes. And then all of a sudden, this thing about, well, those Muslims, good thing we're keeping those people out. You know, it is tough to say, hey, hold on a second here, sir. I take umbrage, and I don't care for your tone, and good day to you, sir.
I said good day.
So that is really tough to do, right? Especially if you know this person to any degree. You know, you have to just gently say, hold on a second here now. Let's think about what you're saying. You know, I personally have a lot of Muslim friends. I serve with them. I couldn't have done my mission in places like sub-Saharan Africa without Muslims who are helping us. Let's talk about what you're really concerned about and not just slur a whole group like that. And they're usually pretty receptive to that.
Well, that's actually good to know. Most of the times I've run into it recently were people I didn't know super well. They're usually people that kind of sort of know me. So yeah. In the past, I have had what you're talking about, and that's a little bit easier to have the longer conversation where you're like, let's see if we can change a mind. There have been times I used to work at a gym, and so the patrons would come in, and when you work at a gym and you're sitting behind the desk and you're like, welcome, swipe your card. Hey, do you want a protein shake?
Yeah.
I think everyone just assumes you think the same way they do. Because sure. I had a lot of liberals who would come up and talk to me about, you know, whatever they were feeling. But, you know, good news for them. I felt the same way. They were right. They sized me up correctly. But a lot of guys would come in and say other things that I was like, whew, you got to put on the brakes. And in my case, also being an employee, I couldn't let me like, a lot of times I had to be like, nah, it's not acceptable. No, you know, it's not acceptable. But yeah, it's good to reach out. I think that it's tough. I think a lot of it is trying to figure out where that line is. I wanted to use that to sort of transition a little bit. You talked about talking to people and they're like, oh, good thing we're keeping those Muslims out.
Yeah.
That's one of the other things that happened.
Yeah.
Because we had that big travel ban and we have to kind of wrap up here. We don't have a whole lot of time left, but I want to talk. So this ban was put in place.
Yeah.
I believe the Trump team, or at least conservative news outlets, because I've been listening to some conservative news outlets to try to get out of my bubble. And I will say that some of them have fallen by the wayside because they kind of make me angry. I feel like some of them are a little bit cynical. They're aiming to sow a message and they sort of don't care whether or not the message is accurate. And some of them I just listen to anyway, because I also have to realize that I have a bias. So I'm just going to listen. So at least I understand what everyone else on the other side is talking about, how they see it.
Sure.
And one of the things that they're saying is they're calling it a travel ban. Everyone I know calls it a Muslim ban. It sounds like the Ninth Circuit. So there was a judge in Washington that put the travel ban or the Muslim ban on hold.
Right.
And then it had to go to the Ninth Circuit to decide if that hold could stay or not. And the Ninth Circuit said, yes, the hold stays. And that was three judges. That was someone that was appointed by Jimmy Carter, someone who was appointed by Obama, I think, and someone who was appointed by George W. Bush, I think.
Yeah.
And so you got kind of a mix in there, but it was unanimous. They all said, this is not constitutional, at least as it's written currently. And that's like a big deal. So that was kind of a thing. They threw this in place just one afternoon, like a Friday.
Yeah.
I believe. Was it a Friday or was it a Saturday?
It was a Friday.
And they started rejecting people from airports as soon as like Friday night and Saturday. So you said you went down to the Dallas-Fort Worth airport to sort of like, were you there to protest? I went to the Philadelphia airport to protest.
We were there with a group of protesters and also a group of lawyers. So this, you know, starting with the Women's March the day after the inauguration and up till even now, like my inbox is constantly being filled with calls to action by these groups that didn't exist 3 weeks ago. But as soon as that travel ban was issued and people started being detained at airports, hundreds of lawyers, probably thousands nationwide, decided, hey, we're immigration lawyers, or we're just lawyers in general. We can actually do something about that. So here at the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, 140 lawyers ultimately came together. They rented a hotel room at the Hyatt, which is right there located at the airport. And then a bunch of folks, my wife and I included, went there to support them and to bring them snacks. And, you know, because they started manning the International Arrivals Hall 24/7 for any indication that someone was being detained. So we had a bunch of folks there who were protesting because there were cameras, and they wanted to make sure that that message was being projected. But then we were also, as people came out of the International Arrivals Gate, asking them, you know, what flight they were on, if they had seen anyone who looked like they were being detained, and then if there were family members who were hanging around for what seemed like long periods of time in the arrival hall, asking them, hey, are you waiting for somebody? And in a few cases, they were, right? And so those lawyers were able to then step in and offer them some free legal counsel. And this group of lawyers filed what do they call it? Habeas corpus petitions.
Yes.
And ultimately were able to get everybody released because there was just no legal basis for detaining green card holders or people with visas. And then I spent, it was amazing. We didn't spend a lot of time doing it. And then all of a sudden there's a very sweeping legal decision. So they kind of stood down that effort. But that was just one example of, you know, things that are happening now that just didn't happen, you know, under Obama or before that.
Yeah. When I went down to Philadelphia's airport, unfortunately, I don't know any lawyers. So I just went down and yelled a bunch. I was like, ah, and, you know, it was a little more organized than that. They had chants and things, but I went down because I felt like it was one of those things where, again, like that message needs to be projected. And that message is that people have very strong opinions about this, and it's not, I think it's being portrayed by a little bit of this administration and some conservative media outlets that, you know, hey man, this is just a thing, and like, I don't know what the big deal is. And you know what? Not a whole lot of people think it's a big deal anyway, especially that last part. I was like, well, what I can do is I can at least show up and offer like my body for a couple of hours and literally be like, take a picture of me, and here I am.
Right.
Luckily in Philadelphia, the mayor actually came down. The mayor, Jim Kenney, really liberal guy. The mayor came down, a couple of Congress people came down, like our Washington Congress folks, and a senator rushed over from a fundraiser he was at and made a point to, they called a bunch of lawyers, and these lawyers showed up. And again, they were doing a very similar job that you were talking about, where they were making sure that people had representation. They were able to stop. They sent one family back, which was absolutely heartbreaking because, you know, this family went through the vetting process for 2 years and they were coming over, and they had the bad luck of flying in the day the travel ban was instituted, and they sent them back to Syria. Now, luckily, I read an article. Luckily, the city of Philadelphia and the lawyers involved were able to get them back. They were able to get them back on a plane, because that's what everybody was worried about, is like, you know, once you send someone back, like, who knows, where are they going to go? Do they have a support system where they were running from?
Yeah.
Maybe, maybe not. And luckily, though, like, now Philadelphia is taking in all these refugees who are not refugees, but all these people who already had visas who are coming over, thanks to the work of these lawyers, thanks to the work of the mayor coming down and insisting that this happen. And like you were saying, like, this didn't exist a year ago.
Right.
In fact, this didn't even exist in like December.
Right.
So it's important, I think, that people remember that it's, I recently went on a vacation to Florida, and while I was gone, I turned my activism over to some friends. I was like, hey, can you run my group? So a big thanks to Craig and Emily, because they were the ones. Craig is on that Overdue podcast I told you about that everyone should go listen to.
Okay.
But Craig and Emily were good enough to send out, they were good enough to send out these prompts that we do every day. We call certain senators, and it was really tempting to not go back to making these calls. It was very tempting to be like, well, I don't like Trump, and maybe every now and again I'll post something on Facebook. But, and it wasn't something that I gave a lot of thought to, but it's important to remember that this work wasn't happening last year. And that's part of the reason that we're in the situation we're in, is that we've kind of been sleeping for a while.
Yeah.
And now that we're awake, we sort of need to stay awake, and we need to stay uncomfortable, because especially people like me and you, Matt, who are white middle-aged guys.
Yeah.
You know, I can just blend into the background pretty sure. easily, and I wouldn't have to do any work. And eventually Donald Trump will be voted out, hopefully in 4 years, maybe in 8 years. Assuming he doesn't completely crash the country, I'll be fine in the long run.
Yeah.
But it's important that we don't fall into that sort of like, well, like the big argument that gets me is when people go, well, I mean, they're all corrupt. What's the point? And that makes me want to pull my hair out because there is a difference. There's a difference if you get into senators and congresspeople that you don't agree with. There's a difference in there too. There are people in the Republican Party who I would never ever want to be president, but they're not like corrupt.
You're right.
They have ideas I disagree with. So to say like, oh, they all lie, they're all corrupt, why pay attention? You know, it's very frustrating because usually the people who say that I know they're usually middle class white people who don't really have much to lose. They don't have a lot of actual skin in the game. I mean, they do, right. but they don't. They don't have skin in the game like a lot of my gay friends do, or like a lot of my people, sure. Friends of color do.
Now, they may have things, they may have skin in the game that they're just not aware of. And things like this have actual, you know, having Donald Trump as president of the United States has actual consequences. I spent a lot of time, you know, between the time when that I'm kind of fired up about this particular issue, between the time when the executive order was issued and the time that the, you know, we just got this judicial extension of the stay, in that this has serious national security consequences. When I was in Iraq, when I was in West Africa, I relied upon local people as translators, as drivers, as what we called fixers. You know, like I was a deputy commander of a group that had three different bases. There's no banking system, effective banking system in the country of Niger, for example. We had to pay our electric bills for the airbase in cash. So I had to have a guy that we hired to take us to the company of to the office of the electric company and facilitate the transaction whereby we paid our electric bill in cash. And if we couldn't do that, we were going to have to shut down that airbase or start shipping in thousands of gallons of diesel fuel to run generators to do our mission, right? And one of the things we always have in our hip pocket, and usually you don't have to use it, but sometimes you do, like in Iraq, is that, hey, if you help the Americans and you stick your neck out and you actually risk your life, and things go really bad, we are going to be there for you, and we will get you a refugee visa, and we will get you into the country. We are the United States. We take care of our friends. We're not going to let you down. Well, Donald Trump just announced to the world, you know what? You help the United States. Screw you. You're on your own. And that's going to have real consequences if we want to conduct these counterterrorism operations all around the world. And you know, even middle-aged white people will understand that, you know, if you phrase it in those terms.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. I don't want to say that all middle-aged white people don't understand things. What I'm saying is that usually the people that I run into were people I went to high school with, and there's a lot of layers between them and any real significant blowback in policy that's going to, but you're right. Yeah. You're right. And that, you know, I think that, and I'm glad to hear you say that. I think we have to kind of leave it there because we're going a little long today, but that's good. That means we got a lot of things to talk about.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about our personal sort of like calls to action, like things we're going to do this week. You said last week you went to the Democratic Organization's meeting. You said, what was it, like 500 people in a room that holds 200?
Yeah, it was, you know, at the community college there, they booked the local Democrats, the Dallas County Democrats booked a room, and they got their speakers there, and they, you know, said, we're going to talk about what we're going to do next and do some organization and do some training and maybe get if you want to run for office, we'll help you with that. And they were expecting 20 or 30 people, and 500 showed up.
Wow.
And it was just this amazing thing, right? And everyone was super animated and energetic and angry but determined to get things done. So my wife and I are going to continue to go to these types of meetings and do some organization. You know, I think it's really important that we get Democrats elected to state houses and to the Congress so that we can end gerrymandering and reform campaign finance, actually affect some of these changes and give the Democrats an ability to stop, you know, if Trump's around for a few more years, to, you know, actually influence the legislation that he might be able to pass. So this week we're going to go to an organizational meeting for the campaign of a woman named Jan McDowell. She's going to be running for Texas 24th District for Congress. So we're going to go there on Sunday and help out however we can.
Oh, that's awesome. On a similar note, so I told last week my whole thing was I was going to take a social media break, which I mostly did. And what I mean by that mostly is that I'm still engaged because I prep prompts every day for people to call, but I made a point not to check my phone incessantly and not to just dive down social media rabbit holes about all the things that make me angry.
Yeah.
But what I found in my limited time on social media and on the internet, which was actually very helpful for me to sort of like limit my exposure, because I actually do better work. I actually make better phone calls to Senator Pat Toomey and ask him to please listen to his constituents, which he has a shoddy record of doing, but it is what it is. I do better when I'm not running in the red, which I would have guessed would have been the opposite. I'm like, if I'm super angry, I'll be really effective. But I think we all know that that's not really the case. And one of the things that I discovered on my social media break when I was being more purposeful in how I looked at news and how I looked at things on the internet was I found a book that I'm going to read. It's by a gentleman named Robert Helvey. It was written in 2004. It was recommended to me by somebody online, and then I kind of did a little bit of research on it, called On Strategic Nonviolent Conflict. And it's something that I want to take a look at because it's one of those things where I've been really looking for how to be effective. Like I can yell and scream, and I'm actually pretty good at drawing a line in the sand and being like, I will humiliate you out of this room or whatever. But that, as we all know, that doesn't do a lot of good. Right. At the same time, laying down like a doormat doesn't do a lot of good. So I've been fascinated with how to be effective, and this was something that was recommended to me. So I'm going to give it a listen. Because I'm going to get it on audiobook. I'm going to give it a listen and see what I like taking out of it. Because one of the things that I was talked to about is they said in the book, they talk about things like how the same sex marriage sort of movement, how it became a movement, and how there was a lot of like pressing for it for a long time before it became like, you know, there was like a tidal wave starting around like 2006, 2007, pushing it into the Supreme Court decision that we eventually got. But they said that what got it wasn't legislation. It was what we were talking about, changing minds, which is something that I'm still grasping. I'm still like battling in my brain. But it was kind of what you talked about, the idea that like, you're a person, I'm a person, we can relate on these things, and we can maybe move forward. So On Strategic Nonviolent Conflict is what I'll be reading / listening to for the next. I won't be done by the next podcast, but that's my call to action this week, is I'm going to make myself better at what I do.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, and you can give us a book report next time.
Yes. It'll probably be a chapter or two report, but I will absolutely get that back to you.
Sure.
So, well, that's awesome. Okay. Well, Matt, thanks for sitting down and chatting with me again today. This was really enjoyable.
Sure.
So, I will see you over there.
I'll see you over there as well, Terry.
So thanks, Matt.
Over and out.
Over and out.
Send the word to beware. We'll be over. We're coming over. And we won't come back till it's over.